You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On August 31st, President Obama addressed his nation from the Oval Office to talk about the end of the combat mission in Iraq. While this captured international headlines, the story of a people decimated by years of the harshest economic sanctions of modern times and an illegal occupation remain largely untold. Darj Mail is an award-winning independent journalist, and he has reported on the war from Iraq, and he joins me on the phone this morning. Hello, Dar.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, what did Obama mean when he said ending the combat mission in Iraq? What does that actually look like on the ground?
What it actually looks like on the ground is a rebranding of the occupation. This certainly does not mean an end to the occupation when you have at least 50,000 troops remaining in the country and more than that number of private contractors inhabiting an embassy the size of the Vatican City and at least four permanent massive air bases there. So what they did was to make it appear as though Obama is adhering to his campaign promises of sticking to a withdrawal timetable. While they did draw the number of troops down to 50,000, this actually is in alignment with maintaining adherence to the national security strategy, and something that Obama said himself when he was senator back in 2006 in a speech in Chicago, saying that his long-term vision for U.S. presence in the region was between 50 and 70,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. So what they've done is they've rebranded the troops. Instead of calling them combat troops, they call them support troops. But we've already seen now several instances, even just in the last week, of them being engaged in direct combat.
And is there a schedule for those support troops to leave?
Well, theoretically, they are supposed to leave by the end of 2011, according to the Status of Forces Agreement. But the way the Status of Forces Agreement is written, if the U.S.-backed Iraqi government asks for the U.S. to keep their combat forces, rather their military, in Iraq, then, of course, they will oblige. And we already, just in the last month, had the highest-ranking Iraqi general come out and say that he didn't feel that Iraqi forces would be able to operate independently until at least 2020, and the U.S. would need to remain.
So what does daily life look like for people in Iraq following the years and years of war and occupation?
Well, that's the ongoing tragedy, and one that we basically don't hear hardly anything about anymore, because the Iraqi people, I mean, just since the invasion, we have two independent polls showing that between 1.1 and 1.3 million Iraqis have been killed, probably three and four times that number of wounded. One in three Iraqis don't even have access to clean drinking water. Nearly half the country is living in abject poverty on less than $1 per day. The medical care system is in total shambles. And basically most of the technical class who could afford to leave have long since left. That includes more than half of the doctors in the country, countless academics and other professionals. And so Iraq has then gone from having the highest literacy rate in the Middle East by the late 80s, early 1990s, and seen a steady downward trend directly related to U.S. policy there, to where now they have one of the worst literacy rates. So this, in a very big way, does not bode well for their future.
And what's the level of unemployment in the country?
It vacillates on any given month between 25 and 75%. So it's a very staggering rate of unemployment, and this is also due directly to the U.S. invasion right in the wake of that, when the civil administrator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, under the Coalition Provisional Authority, instituted the 100 Bremer Orders. Much of these were part of what Naomi Klein has referred to as a neoliberal shock doctrine of economics, and what it essentially did was create a Great Depression in Iraq immediately in the wake of the invasion, and that continues to this day.
Now, you mentioned that much of the technical class has left, but the war has also displaced millions of other Iraqi civilians. How has that affected the country?
Well, it's really added to a background of just an ongoing violence and chaos and instability, because we have more than 1 million people have fled the country altogether. Some estimates for that are as high as 3 million, unofficial estimates. And internally, we're still looking at approximately 1 million people internally displaced. And some of this is because of violence. Some of this is because of past U.S. military operations like that in Fallujah, which largely destroyed the city. So we still have people roaming around looking for shelter, looking for jobs. And this has just further increased the overall instability of the country.
So are they in refugee camps then?
Some of them are. Some of them are staying with friends. Some of them are now on the street. Last time I was there last year, I literally met people that were still living in bombed out buildings since the invasion.
Now, there have been billions of dollars of aid money going to Iraq. What has happened to all this money?
Well, most of it has, I think, been victim of corruption. Both, first, I think the brunt of it went into the U.S. And other Western companies operating in Iraq, the companies like the Halliburtons, the Bechtels, the Dyncors, the Blackwaters, etc., where they've made record-setting profits for themselves. And much of the money that was originally slated to go into reconstruction ended up getting transferred over into these quote-unquote security companies like the Blackwaters. So a lot of it has gone to that, which I think is a direct result of Western corruption, of basically getting as much of that money as they can, basically saying to hell with Iraqi reconstruction and what's best for the Iraqi people. The other part of the money has gone to corruption within the Iraqi government itself. And these are people that Iraqis themselves call the IIPs, imported Iraqi politicians, because most of them had fled the country back in the 70s during the early days of Saddam's reign, and then they came back in on the backs of the American tanks. And these people, like the Ahmed Chalabis, the Nouri al-Malikis, the Adnan Pachachis, we can go on down a long list, have basically made themselves very, very rich by channeling a lot of this money, in fact, billions of dollars of this reconstruction money into their own pockets, or more precisely, into their European bank accounts.
Now, anti-war activists have been saying for years that the Iraqi war was about oil. Has some of that money gone into maintaining the oil supply?
Absolutely. We've seen a long, slow march, kind of three steps forward, two back, from the beginning of the invasion, of an effort for Western oil companies to get their hands on Iraqi oil, a concerted effort to denationalize that oil and privatize it. And it's been a very slow process, but we are now seeing Western companies now slowly but surely getting a more firm grip on that oil supply. And in fact, some of that oil is already being transported and processed by Western companies.
What can you tell us about the Iraqi elections that happened earlier this year?
Well, this really has set the stage for, I think, a lot of the violence that we've seen on the ground in the last months and that continues to this day. It's been a very, very high level of violence. We had an election where Nouri al-Maliki was actually defeated by the opposition, by Iyad Alawi, who then, to this day, Maliki won't cede control over to Alawi. And so we've had ongoing political instability. We don't have a unified government. In fact, we don't even really have a government that's formed in the wake of this election, because there's so much uncertainty and arguing. And Maliki, to this day, continues to refuse to cede power, even though there's been consistent efforts, some from the Shia bloc, and then others from a more secular bloc, which Alawi heads, to have a more unified government and try to convince Alawi that, hey, you lost the election, you need to let us do what the people voted us in to do. But that's not happening. And so as a result, we're seeing more violence on the streets, of a lot of inter-militia violence happening. And of course, this is just adding to the overall instability that already exists there.
So a disintegrated central government then, in the wake of an election that people didn't trust.
Exactly. That's correct.
What can Canadians do to express their voices or put pressure to influence what's happening in Iraq?
Well, I think, right in line with the occupation of Iraq is the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, which Canada is playing a very large role by having troops there and supporting it, and thus enabling a continuance of that occupation, which is, of course, going very, very badly, and Canadian troops there being killed fairly regularly as well. And I think what Canadians can do is pressure their government to get their troops out of there. There's no reason for them to have troops there other than to assist the U.S. in continuing on in an occupation for their own gain, which is control of pipelines from the Caspian Sea down to the coast through Pakistan, through Afghanistan. So I think that people can and should pressure their political leaders to basically get Canadian troops and support out of the occupation of Afghanistan as quickly as possible.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us today, Dar.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail. He's an award-winning independent journalist who has reported on the war from Iraq. If you would like more information, you can visit his website at darjamailiraq.com. And Dar is spelled D-A-H-R, and Jamail is spelled J-A-M-A-I-L.